Micah, Nahum, and Zephaniah are three little prophets we want to take a look at today. And as we cover the prophets, in some ways they get a little bit repetitious because, as we've talked about before, their favorite text is Deuteronomy. And in some ways you might simply say, okay, the message of all of them is repent, repent, repent. And that's probably true, but I think after a while you would get the point. So we're not going to cover that exactly. We're going to try to talk about some of the highlights, some of the uniquenesses, some of the things which make these books special. And that's where we're going to go today. A little preview, first of all. God the King, God the Protector, and God the Preserver of Truth, Micah, Nahum, and Zephaniah, respectively. We're going to take a look at why the world secretly dreams about the leadership that only Jesus can give. They don't know it as He, but we all long for it. We'll talk about what it means to really trust God when other people treat you badly. Nahum really focuses on that. And then Zephaniah's big idea is why also is such a very wicked word. Don't ever use the word also. Strike it from your vocabulary and never use it again. Or at least in the context in which Zephaniah uses the word also. So let's talk about some historical background. I'm on page 96, if you're there as well, and I want to put these prophets in historical perspective, first of all. Israel is exiled in 722. Judah, of course, hangs on until 586. And the prophets we're going to talk about fit in between these two times. We looked at Isaiah a couple times ago, and he is right around 722. Micah, Nahum, and Zephaniah fit right in here. Their goal, of course, is to prevent the exile from happening and try to keep Judah from being taken away. They are unsuccessful, not because they are failures, but because the people don't respond to them. Right? So let's take a look at Micah first. And what Micah's big idea, his big theme is all about, is in fact Messiah. It's all about the leadership. It's all about Israel meeting the ultimate king. Everything from beginning to end focuses upon this. And I want to take a look, first of all, at the effect of Messiah on the world. And you will see it here in Micah chapter 4. It starts out with these words. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up the mountain of the Lord to the house of God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. An idea, a dream, which is categorically different than what you find today. When was the last time you saw any world leader say, hey, let's have a conference in Jerusalem and go up and learn about what the law teaches? It's just not going to happen in this time of history. But it will happen because of Messiah. Messiah will make this happen when he comes. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So it will be the central political center of the world. And the law and instruction will go out from there sometime in the future. And he, Messiah, will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. And then they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. How many people have seen that phrase before? I mean, let me see your hands. You've seen it in other literature. Right? This is one of those things that once you recognize where it comes from, you might start seeing it everywhere. Like you can see it in songs, you see it in poetry, you see it in literature. It's a fairly famous idea, and a lot of people way outside Christian circles have grabbed hold of it, and for good reason. Number one, it's beautifully poetic. Beat their swords into plowshares, and nation not taking up sword against nation. And besides that, it's just not just poetic, but it's powerful. Here, for example, is a statue outside the United Nations in New York City. And you can see here is a guy who has his sword, and he's beating it into a plowshare. And it's a metaphor, it's a picture of taking all of our military might and putting it into economic benefit. Now, just imagine what that would be like if it happened today. I don't know if you're a student of political history or recent history, but the reason why we have moved from the Cold War into the era in which we move now is because of Ronald Reagan's buildup of arms and the former Soviet Union trying to keep up with that. And basically what happened was they were bankrupt because they couldn't keep up with it. They just didn't have any more money to put into the military buildup. And can you imagine what it would be like if the United States or other nations today took all the money which we use for military uses and put it into economic production, put it into plowshares? Right? What would happen to hunger around the world? It's just amazing, amazing changes. Now, the thing that really makes this picture ironic is that that statue was given as a gift to the UN by the former Soviet Union back during the Cold War, really kind of working against it on the one hand, but pretending to be a peaceful nation on the other. But these things which everybody longs for are really just pipe dreams. There's no way the UN is ever going to produce that. Not that they shouldn't try necessarily, but it's a little bit like Genesis chapter 11, remember, with the Tower of Babel. These are great dreams, great ideas. They are God's goals, and we want all of God's goals just without God. Right? Kind of the John Lennon-esque idea, imagine all the world. Let's get all these great ideas and the peace which God wants, but let's not include God. Well, ain't going to happen without Messiah to make it all happen. Second, about the effect of Messiah on Israel. That's the effect of Messiah on the world, going to be a world leader. But it will have an effect on Israel as well. And I take it you will recognize this verse either from when we talked about it before or from the New Testament, a famous passage that the scribes go to when Herod the Great asks them, where will the boy be born? And they go to Micah 5:2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel. His origins are from old, from ancient times. And it's just a, I hate to say God is a genius. Like God really needs me to build him up here. But this is just so beautiful, because Bethlehem is that little, you know, little town just 3 or 4 miles south of Jerusalem. The topography of Israel, that you know about by now, is such that in the north you get these beautiful flat farm fields, but in the south you got these deep ravines, and you can't really farm those ravines and mountains, but you can grow things down there. And things you grow are things that go bah, you know, and things that, like goats and sheep. That's what you grow down here. And it so turns out that there's a huge need for sacrificial lambs in Jerusalem. And throughout history, places where they were grown were Bethlehem. That's why shepherds like David live in Bethlehem. Born in Bethlehem, and all the little lambs that were sacrificed were born in Bethlehem. All of them. That's pretty beautiful the way it all comes together. Therefore, Israel will be abandoned, that is, in terms of a king, in terms of a leader, until the time when she who is in labor gives birth, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. And he will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. So looking forward to a time when Israel is abandoned with, in terms of leadership, but a new leader will be provided, and he will gather Israel together and make her safe. And all of that, of course, hasn't happened yet. We learned about this before when we took a look at the genre of poetry, remember? Can you remember where all those things fit in the timeline? Therefore, Israel will be abandoned refers to what time? Yeah, probably 586, right? Because that's where the last Davidic king to reign on the throne, Jehoiachin, is taken over to Babylon. 7 years later, Zerubbabel comes back. But Zerubbabel, even though he has royal blood, does not reign on the throne. And so we are abandoned in terms of a king until the time when she who is in labor gives birth, and the rest of his brothers, until the time when she was in labor gives birth, which is what time period?
Four.
Right? And the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites, so it's not really until the second coming that the king comes back to reign over the nation and over the world. In terms of the little mountain peaks, there you see 2, 3, and 4. And again, just want you to remember that. I trust that you look at that and say, okay, I know that. That's good. And if you do, that's important for your understanding of the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the final celebration as well. Okay. So what we're going to do is add one more little level to our messianic block here. And we talked about this on Monday, the 2 Samuel 7. What makes those first four blocks similar? What is there that's the same about 3, 12, 49, and 7? They're all about who, right? Genesis 2:15, Messiah will be a son of Eve. Genesis 12, also a son of Abraham. Genesis 49, also a son of Judah, and 2 Samuel 7, also a son of David. Yeah, so all of these have to do with who, and the next one then has to do with where. Where is he going to be born? He's going to be born in Bethlehem. And before we're finished with this semester, we will put not only where, but what, and when, and something else up there. So I kind of leave David there, sort of closed in there, just because he is the very last who we have, and that's why he's always known as the son of David. If it hadn't been for 2 Samuel 7, I suppose he might have been known in the New Testament as the son of Judah, or some such thing. So one last little thing to tell you about, and I just think this one's really, really amazing as well. The very last verse of the book says, "You will be true to Jacob and show mercy to Abraham as you pledged on oath to our fathers in days long ago." Now, given the context of Micah, you all now know what that means. What does it mean? You'll be true to your promises and you will show mercy to Abraham because you will bring about what you promised to them, namely in terms of Messiah. Right? That's the theme of this book. That's the big idea of this book. Now, if you hadn't had this class, if I hadn't led you through that, how many people would have really known what Micah 7:20 was? How many people would have even recognized it as a verse out of the Scriptures? And yet, I find it's interesting that there was at least one 16-year-old kid, probably, who has done this, so that when an angel came and said, "You're going to be the mother of Messiah," her response was, look at this, "He has helped us serve in Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants forever, even as he said to our fathers." Now, do you see where she got it from? It's not word for word, but it's a pretty good paraphrase of Micah 7:20. Interpreted contextually, perfectly, gets the point. Mary's amazing. I just think that ought to be, I don't know if it should be an encouragement to us or a rebuke to us. Certainly if we say things like, "Gee, I just wish God were more real in my life. God isn't real in my life." I doubt that Mary felt that way even before the angel came to her, because her head was just so immersed in God's words and God's promises, God's scriptures. I was just reading some of my devotional time this morning, spent some time with C.S. Lewis, and C.S. Lewis is an excerpt from Screwtape Letters, and one of the head demons is writing to a younger demon and saying, "Now, one of the things you've got to make sure they continue to think is that the 24 hours they have belong to them." And I think about the way we use our time, think about how much time we have or how little time we have, and think about how much time she had to do that. And you might say, "Well, her life wasn't nearly as busy as ours." Yeah, I want to bet. It's kind of scratch out a living in the first century. It took every bit of time you had. But somehow she had time to have Micah, even Micah, hidden in her heart. So I hope that, I don't mean to throw guilt trips on us, I hope that's encouragement to us to spend the time. Now, I don't know what you're doing Friday morning, but I hope you get a chance Friday morning to really sit down and just get by yourself and with a word and just think about what Friday's all about for you. So let's go on to Nahum, okay? Pull out your Bibles with me, if you will. And we're going to look at some of the passages here. I don't have all the scriptures up on the screen. So I want you to get them out. I'm going to start with a little multiple choice test. According to Nahum, multiple choice, my God is A, holy, B, glorious, C, sarcastic, D, vengeful, or the ultimate wicked professorial answer, two of the above. And I'll give you the right answer is E, two of the above. Now, all you have to do is figure out which two. Which two of the above are they? According to Nahum, the only right answers here are sarcastic and vengeful, the two things your mother told you never to be. At least my mom did. Why are you so sarcastic all the time? I don't know, just am. But according to Nahum, that's what we're going to find. Before we delve right into the text and give me a chance to prove my point, look with me on page 98 at the comparison between the two prophets who are associated with the Assyrian capital of Nineveh. Now again, I say very carefully, associated with. I didn't say the two prophets who went there, because they don't both go there. But we know that Jonah and Nahum were associated with it. So the answer to these questions are singular. That is, there is only one right answer, and the other is obviously not right. So when I say who went to Nineveh, we know the right answer is Jonah, and my point is, by implication, Nahum did not go to Nineveh. Okay. Number two, who preached to Ninevites? Well, again, it has to be Jonah because he's the only one who went there. And the point is that Nahum did not preach to them. He preached about them, but he preached to Judah. Okay. The next one, who preached salvation? This one's kind of funny if you think about it. Who preached so the people got saved? Yeah, Jonah did. And who preached destruction? Well, Nahum did that. Now, don't you guess that, you know, when the, you know, if the assignments had been handed out, that Jonah would have been really jealous of Nahum, knowing what you know about him? How come he gets to preach destruction? You know, that's what I want to do. Please, I'll trade you. I'll trade you. No, you can't trade. Finally, who wrote his letter to comfort Israel? Kind of a cute question, trick question. Do you know why it's a trick question? Because what? Because what? Because neither. No, actually, one of them does. Their answer is right for one of them. It's a trick question because the word comfort, the way you say it in Hebrew, is Nahum. Okay. His name, Nahum, means be comforted. Right? And it is a comfort, but in a backhanded kind of a way, in a very indirect way, and we will see how that happens as we move through here. Okay? Now, I suppose the historical background you really need to understand this is how wicked Assyrians are. Assyrians were some of the first people to be known for using psychological warfare. And they wouldn't just come in and defeat their enemies. They would come in and terrify their enemies. They would come in and they would skin people alive. They just had all sorts of really, really cruel things, and the psychological warfare, the intimidating warfare, was a part of what they were known for, and no one really felt real kindly towards the Assyrians. And this book is about the day when the Assyrians, and Nineveh in particular, will fall. So let's start out in Nahum chapter 1. Look with me at the text, and we're going to take a look at his character as it is stated very early in the book, chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. And all that we've said about how to interpret a book still applies here. In the very beginning, God is going to give us a propositional statement, kind of a caption about where we're headed. And that's why you can't miss how important verse 2 is. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and maintains his wrath against his enemies. And so you're going to get a very vengeful, mean kind of a God here. And even as you look down here through verses 4 and 5 and 6, look at them. He rebukes the sea and it dries up. He makes all the rivers run dry. Verse 5, the mountains quake before him. The hills melt away. The earth trembles at his presence. The world and all who live in it. Now, the reason why Nahum says this is because there are a lot of people saying, we sure haven't seen it yet. I mean, Assyria came and gobbled up the 10 northern tribes, and it doesn't look like God knows. Does God know this? Does God care? And what Nahum is basically going to say is, he does care, and he does see, and someday he's going to act with amazing power, just not quite yet, but someday he will. So watch how he will take vengeance here. And in 2a, the first chapter here, his character shown in vengeance on Assyria, he talks about 1b, the completeness of her end. I'm not going to read the verses, but he says Assyria is going to come to a complete end, and she's going to come to a permanent end. She's not going to raise up again. And in fact, it's going to be soon. And all the first and second chapter here are about Assyria getting her just desserts. Now, what I want you to really focus in on is this. Look at chapter 2, verses 3 to 9. Now, just read on your own. Just read verses 3 and 4 and 5 and tell me, from a literary standpoint, what kind of writing is this? What is the author trying to do? Right? Chapter 2, verses 3 and 4 and 5. Just make some observations. This is the way it's written. What do you see? It's what, cousin? It's poetic, that's for sure. I'll take that one. It's poetic. What else?
It's extremely red.
It's extremely red. Yeah, it is that, isn't it? Why is it so red?
Because blood is red.
Maybe because blood is red. Yeah, I think that's part of the idea. Everything is red and scarlet, and things are flashing around. It's poetic. It's colorful. The way I stated it is this very graphic and detailed account of the battle as you read through there. The shields of the soldiers are red. The warriors are clad in scarlet. The metal on the chariots flashes on the day they're made ready. Chariots storm through the streets, rushing back and forth. So he's really trying to create this picture so you can see it, so you can feel it. And then it gets even more like that in under 3b, the city's defeat. Take a look with me at chapter 3, because it's even intensified. Read chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. I mean, they're just very short, little staccato sentences. The writer is trying to just jolt you. Right? The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses, jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords, glittering spears, many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over corpses. I think, man, he's just really trying to picture this thing. It's like the closest thing you get to an Old Testament video before there's a video, you know? It's just really trying to make this very clear. It's even more graphic when you get here. So it's like the author, the writer Nahum, is not just describing it, but really kind of enjoying it and really getting into it. And then you get 4b, the hopelessness of the city. There's this comparison to Thebes. Thebes was like Nineveh in that it was a city that was well protected with a river that ran around it, and it worked like this perpetual moat. And Assyria destroyed Thebes, and God says, or Nahum says to them, hey, the same way you took Thebes, we're going to take you. To get to the end, there's a sarcastic address to prepare for the enemy. Chapter 3, verse 14. Notice what it says. Draw water for the siege, strengthen your defenses, work the clay, tread the mortar, repair the brickwork, and there the fire will devour you. Now, the idea is something like this. Oh, sure, go ahead, try to defend yourselves. A lot of good that's going to do. It's like this, just very sarcastic. Oh, yes, get yourselves ready. Build those walls up, and we're just going to smash them down. And then finally, at the very end, the climax is a statement made to the king, who, of course, is responsible for his country. And they even begin to insult him and talk about how he's really, his nobles lie down to rest, your people are scattered like you're a mama's boy. You know, if this were an athletic endeavor, we would call this what? If we were in a basketball court or football field, what would you call this? This is trash talk. Yeah, this is just really psychological kind of warfare given back to them. It's like mocking them. It's very graphic and detailed. Now, you see this, and you have to ask yourself, okay, now what do I learn about God from this? Doesn't exactly sound like Psalm 23, does it? I mean, it doesn't sound like a very nice person, does it? It sounds like a God who is vengeful and full of wrath and ready to go after him and just tear him apart. Why is it an important message? Because at this point, he has not yet done it. And what Nahum is saying is he is going to do it someday. Because people were looking and saying, does God care? Does God notice? He doesn't say it in exactly these words, but Zechariah has a very similar statement about God taking vengeance on Israel's enemies. And here's the way he says it in Zechariah. So this is what the Lord Almighty says. After you sent me against the nations that have plundered you, wherever touches you, touches the apple of his eye, I will surely raise my hand against them so that their slaves will plunder them. Then you will know the Lord Almighty has sent me. And the very center of it all is, whoever touches you touches the apple of his eye. Now, it's a really unfortunate translation. People have really simply misunderstood King James language because it talked about the apple of one's eye. King James translated correctly. The trouble is that apple of one's eye meant a different thing back then than it does today. When you think of the apple of someone's eye, you probably think of an image like this, like this beautiful apple that someone has their eye set on that they really cherish and treasure. And that's the way the figure of speech has been misconfigured today. But that's not what it meant in 1611, and that's certainly not what it meant when Zechariah talked about it. Really, the word for apple, when King James translated it, was really the word for pupil. So really, this is what we're talking about. Now, do you understand what difference that makes? Let's think about it. Christine, would you help me out?
Do you have contact lens? Okay, and just put your head back here for a second, okay? I have a pen, and I would like to, is it okay if I would just put my initials on the pupil you're on? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Come on, it's for the benefit of everybody here. It's like 150 people are going to see this and watch this, okay? So for the class, would you take one for the team? Come on, let me do it. It won't hurt much. Okay, come on, let me just open up one, okay? You ready? You don't think you're really going to do it, do you? I'm going to do it. Are you nuts? Are you crazy? You totally lost it?
Can you imagine anything more painful than someone taking deliberately a point of a pen or something and touching your pupil with it? Do you think there's ever a time when someone could touch the pupil of your eye and you wouldn't know it? If someone touches one of God's people, God feels it deeply, intimately, immediately, and knows it. And what Nahum is saying here, and what Zechariah is saying, is that when people touch his people, he knows it. And he will respond by taking the proper justice and vengeance in the right time, in the right way. And you can't accuse him of not having zeal to do that. Now, I don't know if this is a comfort or not, but you realize this is why, this is a very freeing truth. This is why you and I don't have to take vengeance on our own. Imagine somebody in your head right now, just for a second. Imagine somebody who has hurt you in the past. Or not too distant past. Someone who said something about you or cheated on you or done something evil to you or lied about you, and they have hurt you. What is your natural reaction to that? Natural reaction is, all I want is just some justice here, right? But the Bible says you ought not to take your own vengeance. Why? Because God says he will do it. Do you understand that the truth here from Nahum is why the New Testament teachings on revenge work? This is why it worked. Romans chapter 12 says this: "Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay.'" Vengeance is not a wicked thing. Vengeance is only wrong when you and I try to do it ourselves. God says, no, you don't know how, you don't know when, you don't know how much. You leave this to me. Justice is a good thing, but don't you try to do it. Here's what he goes on to say. And here's what I actually say, what we say. When I take my own vengeance, what I'm saying is, God, I don't trust you to do your job. Or to say, I want to be in control of the situation because I'm not sure you're really handling it correctly. And what Nahum does is come along and say, listen, God will do his job, and God will do it correctly. And if you just by faith let him do it, that frees you up to respond in a very different way. And from now on, I don't have to say, oh, I've got to get you back, or I've got to get even. You can say, you know what? God's going to do that. God's going to take care of vengeance, and it frees me up to do what is good so that I can overcome evil with good. I can feed people who are my enemies, and I can bless those who curse, and I can say, Father, forgive them. In fact, I will know I have trusted God to avenge me when I want good for the other person. So whoever that person was you had envisioned, can you envision yourself praying for really good things to happen to them? When you come to the point where you pray for good things to happen for them, and where you bless them instead of curse them, then you will know that you have taken the message of Nahum to heart and said, God, I really trust you to do your job. And I don't have to do it. And that's a powerful, powerful, freeing outlook that God provides for us through the book of Nahum and through New Testament teaching about Nahum. So let it work. Let it do its work this weekend. Give you a different attitude towards a lot of people, probably. All right, we got one more book to look at before we are done. So let's go to Zephaniah, okay? Zephaniah is the book to read when you find yourself sinking to the level of the crowd. Because we all know that every place has its culture. Every church has its culture. Every school has its culture. Cedarville has its own little subculture. We have our ways, our habits of doing things. And if you have ever given it an ounce of thought, you will recognize that not everything about Cedarville culture is positive. We do a lot of things that are bad. Not because Cedarville is a bad place to be, but because it's filled with sinners, unfortunately. Wherever you go, whatever church you go to, whatever school you go to, you're going to have parts of the culture, the way things are done, that are not really honoring to God. There's sort of this herd mentality, and people get into it, so they do it. You know, ways we think about certain issues in life, and you know what I'm talking about. And sometimes you say, you know, everybody else seems to be doing it this way, but I'm just reading the scriptures, and I'm convicted about this. I don't think it's right. And when you find yourself getting tired of trying to hold yourself to a higher standard than perhaps some of the culture around you, and you find yourself sinking to the level of the crowd, then Zephaniah is a good book to read at those times. Because the basic message of the book is, God doesn't grade on a curve. It doesn't really matter what everybody else is doing. None of us is ever going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and ever offer the lame excuse, but everybody else, you know, so I can't imagine what God's going to say. I know what my mom would say. I know what your mom would say, probably, if you ever tried to offer that excuse. Everybody else is doing that. Yeah. And it's just not going to work with God either. God doesn't grade on a curve. So to put the big idea in perspective, you can just see it from the outline here. As you take a look at the outline on page 102, the 2C and the 1C and 3C, all that stuff, there is this statement about judgment coming against all the nations. And if I can summarize it, I would say it something like this. Everybody's sinning. And Zephaniah says, fine, everybody's going to get judged. God doesn't grade on the curve, that's the idea. And so what he has here is 2C, 3C, 4C, and 5C. You will notice, without much reflection, that there are all four corners of the compass. Nations to the west, Philistia, to the east, Moab and Ammon, to the south, Ethiopia, and to the north, Assyria. And I really think he's working hard to mention nations that are all around Israel. Not just the most wicked nations, but particularly nations that kind of touch all four points of the compass. The reason I say that is because, you know, we know the Philistines have their bad traits, and Moab and Ammon do too, and so does Assyria. But look at poor Ethiopia. And really, where in the rest of the Old Testament do you ever run into very wicked Ethiopians? Those nasty Ethiopians, you know, you just never find it. Ethiopia is so far away that you don't often find scriptures related to them. But what do they have going for them? Well, unfortunately, the thing they have going for them, at least in Zephaniah's scheme here, is that they are to the south. And they are wicked, like everybody else is wicked, I suppose. But it just emphasizes the fact here is the idea of everybody's universal. But even though it is universal, even if everybody's doing it, everybody's going to get judged, there's also another observation you ought to be able to make from looking at that outline. What else do you notice? Not just all four points of the compass, but what else do you see? Come on, it's worth an egg. It's worth a Cadbury egg, isn't it? Bessie, can we give them one of your eggs here? Come on, you don't mind. You got somebody in bed, you know, you know something else. You're amazing, isn't it?
They're bookends by Judah and...
You even use the right word. You get the whole thing to God. They're bookends right here. It starts with Judah and ends with Jerusalem. Same thing, just different, you know, kind of literary variety. Judah, of course, is the tribe, and Jerusalem is the city here. But what it's saying is that everybody is going to be judged, and it's going to begin and end with God's people, right? And it's the same principle we're seeing back with Amos. Everybody's sinning, everybody's going to get judged, especially the people who know better. That's where it's going to be begin and end. So there's no different way around it. Yeah. What is it that Zephaniah sees that he is so upset about that is so worthy of judgment? Well, that's where we want to go next. And probably the best illustration is found in the very first chapter, in the first couple of verses. Zephaniah 1, 4 and 5, which says this, I will stretch out my hand against those who bow down on the roofs to worship the starry host, those who bow down and swear by the Lord and who also swear by Molech. Now, I've underlined some wicked things. You know, and the question is, which is the most objectionable? Is it bowing down? Is it the worship of stars, the astrology? Is the worship of the false gods Molech that require child sacrifice? What's the most wicked word? Well, In the preview, I already told you that also is the most wicked word. Now, does that make sense to you why I would pick also? Well, what's so negative about also? It's not just the study of Molech, I mean the worship of Molech. It's that the people swear by the Lord and by Molech. It's the mixing together. It's the word we would use for syncretism. Okay? It's a fancy word for Old Testament idolatry, but it's not just Old Testament. New Testament happens as well. When you mix truth and errors, because you understand the only way you can really understand truth and preserve truth is by separating it from error. So when you mix them together, you lose it. It's the very same thing we saw back in Genesis 6, you know, with the sons of God and daughters of men. It was the mixing of the seed. Now, the opposite of syncretism is the teaching that we call around here integration. It's the careful collection of truth while separating it from error. And if you've talked about this in spiritual formation or perhaps in other classes, depending upon your discipline, these are two opposite ends of the spectrum. Syncretism is when you do the job badly. Integration is when you do it correctly. And the goal of our Christian university is, in fact, to investigate all knowledge and try to pick out what's true and separate it from what's wrong. Now, it happens on an academic, intellectual level, you know, in ways like this. We're going to let the little figures at the top represent bodies of knowledge, you know, psychology, education, theology. You might even think about all the books in the library that talk about psychology right there. And obviously, some of it's going to be true and some of it's going to be false, right? Same thing with education. There's a good educational philosophy and bad educational philosophy. Same thing is true with theology. There's good theology and there's bad theology. And our goal as students, as professors, as people made in the image of God, is to try to separate it out. Figure, okay, here's the blue part. Here's the bad part of psychology and education and theology. And here's the true part. And what we try to do is to gather together what is true and live our lives by that. And it's not something educational, academic thing. You know, we can separate, we can change the names up there and say it's true in the area of dating. You look in the world of dating advice out there, and it's huge. And a lot of it's bad. Some of it's good, a lot of it's bad. You take a look at the philosophy about what it means to be a good church member. Some of it's good, a lot of it's bad. A lot of floating around our culture today that says, hey, you know, you go to the church that meets your needs, and wherever you happen to like the style or whatever, that's where you should go. And it's all about choice, and you're a consumer, and you have choice. And it's just a lot of bad teaching. Same thing about work. What does it mean to be a good worker? What does it mean to be my role in a family? And our goal is to take it and separate truth from error. Now, when you do it badly, and you mix those two together, that's where you end up with the syncretism. Right? Isn't it cool the way syncretism goes from blue to yellow and they're all mixed together? Isn't that a neat talk about educational technique? Right there. So really that's a picture not just of an academic pursuit, but really about what we're about in life, about trying to figure out what does God want me to do? How does he want me to behave as a church member, as a father, as a dad, as a wife, as a child, you know? As a worker, and to try to put it all together. And if you don't do it well, then you end up worshiping God and Molech. And that is the thing, I think, which is most nauseating to God. At least that's what he says in Revelation. Right? I wish you were hot or cold, but it's lukewarmness. It's the mixing that's so nauseating because it ends up being a really, really poor testimony about what's true.